Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down and talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about things we're thinking about.
What a topic. Wow. Things we're thinking about. Basically anything we feel like talking about. This is also our farewell for a while.
Season finale.
This is like a season finale.
Wow.
So listeners, here's what's happening. I'm going on sabbatical for the next 3 months. We decided, you know what? We're just going to shut the podcast down for 3 months and take a sabbatical from podcasting. We'll still put some episodes out, some stuff from the archives as we have done occasionally. We've got five years worth of stuff in the archives, so we'll find a few things to throw out there. Only the good stuff. We're not re-releasing any of the crummy episodes.
You should do the gun control episode. And everybody got mad at Bob online.
Yeah.
Because he disagreed with John Piper.
Yeah.
That one has to go
back out.
That's
a good one. We'll basically put one podcast episode from the archives in the feed each month for November, December, and January, and then we'll be back weekly again in February. So think of it like this. It's like when your favorite show has a season finale and then they got to write some new shows, or it's like every other podcast besides ours where they're like, oh, that was the end of season three. You notice how we don't have season numbers or episodes numbers. We're just, hey, we're here every Wednesday. I don't know what episode this
we're
is.
Relentless.
Let's do this every Wednesday. We just keep talking. So it's probably Wednesday Conversation episode 312 or something. I don't know.
It's way more than that.
Wow. That's a lot of episodes.
It's a lot of episodes. So anyways, we're going to say farewell for a while, but we'll be back.
What
I'm excited about? I'm excited that our listeners are bummed out about that. Like, they don't like us going away. In fact, that one time we went to monthly for a while, they were like, what are you doing?
There was like picketing outside.
Yeah, emails.
Angry emails.
People got serious about their Wednesday conversation.
So thank you, listeners, for caring about what we do and for listening. And here's what we're going to do today. I got three categories to go around the table and talk about. Category one is reading. I want to know, what's the best thing you've read recently, and what's on your to-read list over the next 3 months? So by the time we get back together in February, what are you going to have read? So what have you read recently? What's on your to-read list? The second category is culture. What cultural realities are you most intrigued by right now? What do you see going on in the culture you're kind of paying attention to and keeping your eye on? And the last category is inchoate angst.
You're gonna have to explain what inchoate
inchoate
means.
Is like undefined or not able to be sort of articulated.
Okay,
what's bugging you right now in the church, in discipleship, in leadership, whatever, that you're not really sure how to address, but you're maybe beginning to pray and think about? So this is sort of like, what things are just like bouncing around in your soul? Maybe you're not ready to put a bunch of words to them yet, but they're starting to be things you're thinking about, praying about. So. Man, Chris, you teed us up with a whole episode about that book you were reading a few months ago that, man, a lot of people have been interested in. We've been getting emails of like, hey, that book that Chris was talking about, tell me more about that. So I'm going to start with you. What's the best thing you've read recently and on your list for the next 3 months?
Yeah. So we have been in a series in the book of Galatians. And so I decided for this series, and partly because I hadn't done this in a while, so I was just going to jump deep dive into some theology, some Pauline theology, just for fun. So I've been reading three books because two of these books are pretty thick. One is called Paul and the Gift by John Barclay, who is a professor at Durham University, and is basically a theology of grace according to the Apostle Paul. So just looking at the writings of Paul, and it is set in the context of the theologies of grace during Paul's time. So what were Jewish conceptions of grace, and how do those compare to what is held out in the New Testament? So if you're a theology nerd and you have ever gotten into...
theology nerd book.
Yeah, if you've ever gotten into discussions of new perspectives on Paul, this is definitely part of that conversation. But just some really rich, fascinating stuff as far as the theology of grace, specifically how that is articulated in the writings of the Apostle Paul. So I'm reading that, and along with a book by Stephen Westerholm, which again is kind of an analysis of old perspective, new perspective on Paul, and then a book called Paul and the Law by Brian Rosner. And this is in many ways, a deconstruction of sort of the traditional Reformed view of the third use of the law and saying, hey, that's actually problematic in some ways. And so that has been an interesting read as well. So Pauline theology, man, I've been in Pauline theology.
That's awesome.
And it's been rich. It's been good. It's definitely helped my sermons in Galatians, specifically in this way, that as we understand like the law and legalism, like kind of the common conception of what was going on in first century Judaism, is often what I call like kind of just this hard legalism that they were teaching. Hey, you perform X and you get salvation. So kind of a work wages sort of mentality, where what a number of these books have pointed out is that actually Jewish thought at the time had a pretty developed view of grace, and the arguments that Paul was responding to in the book of Galatians and Romans and others is a little bit more nuanced and detailed, and actually has, I think, yielded some great application for us as a church in the way we think about how we can seek to earn God's approval. So it's been good. I think it's really helped my preaching over the past several weeks.
As a rough summary of that more nuanced view of grace, is it basically grace comes to a certain group of people that, and being part of that group is how you sort of get in on grace?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. But essentially the idea is that the first century Judaism had this view of grace, like that salvation was a gift. There were things that you received from the Lord that you could not necessarily do on your own. But in order to receive it, you had to be righteous.
Gotcha.
So the analogy I used was, hey, you know, you have a teenage son and you're going to buy that teenage son a car. If your son is super, super responsible and, you know, has a job and is going to treat that car well, he sort of earned that, but it's still a gift. It's still a gift, but he's in a position versus the teenage son who is a complete mess and you would never offer that. Yeah. And what, and so what this is like, hey, the gospel says, hey, we're all a mess. We don't deserve it at all. Where first century Judaism said, no, this is how the grace comes to us.
Interesting. Yeah. That's good. All right. So what's on your to read list? Did you tell us that?
No. So I have,
is it like Paul?
Are you
more Paul?
You're actually going to read Paul, the Bible.
I have three. So the three books that are kind of at the top of my list right now, one is a book called Beyond Authority and Submission, by Rachel, is it Green Miller or Miller Green? I get that part. So this gal is writing, sort of in the context of complementarian church culture. She's part of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, so very much in a complementarian setting, but pushing back against some of the ways that this gets expressed. And her argument is more has to do with culture than it does Bible. So I've seen some dust up on it, seen a few people recommend it, a few people critique it, and I thought it'd be sort of interesting. So want to read that. Another book that I want to read kind of along the lines of women's discipleship, and there's a whole reason why I'm reading books in this vein, but The Preacher's Wife by Kate Bowler, who's a professor at Duke University. So she did a study on sort of celebrity women's culture in the Christian world, as far as, hey, within a lot of conservative Christian evangelical circles, ladies aren't given positions of leadership. And so they've carved out sort of within social media and kind of larger platforms, and these gals actually have a voice of authority in the church. And so she's writing about this phenomenon within the church. And so I'm actually had Mindy order it and say, hey, you should read this, and I want to read it too. So those two books. And then the third one is a book on Christian aesthetics by, I think it's called The Beauty of the Infinite, David Bentley Hart. So he's one of the two.
I just read a book review where the reviewer said David Bentley Hart is one of the two most intelligent people working right now in Christian theology.
Yeah, yeah.
Like one of the two top theologians in the world. Now, he's quacky on some stuff.
Yes, he's very quacky.
He's off his rocker on some stuff. And he's super
combative. Oh, super combative. So,
but interesting to read.
Yeah, yeah. So I was reading some similar articles about a recent book that he put out, but I saw several people reference this book of like, hey, on Christian aesthetics, this book is like phenomenal and one of the best things he's written, one of the best things out there. And I've actually been looking for Christian aesthetic books for, this is something for a number of years. And there's a couple of things that I'm working on now that kind of have to do with beauty that I'm thinking about. And I was like, okay, I want to study this book. But yeah, all of that at the same time going, right. I wonder how much I'm going to be able to trust in this book considering how controversial this guy can be sometimes.
Yeah. Dusty, what are you reading? Or what's the best book you've read recently? And then what's on your list?
Lately, what's been a lot of fun to read is Thomas Merton, No Man an Island, which Mike turned me off to. Give me some of that Thomas Merton, which you'd have to go way back in the archives to understand that phrase right there. But it's an enjoyable read. It's kind of a chapter a night kind of read, kind of put balms to your soul kind of read. Recently, last week, picked up again because of a pastoral situation, Good and Angry by David Pollison, which I just feel like it's a super practical book, but it's just like it's a super good read on anger.
Yeah.
And it's just very well done. On the to read list is Unwanted. By Stringer, just ordered that.
It's the one that Chris told us about a few months ago.
Yeah, he did.
Good book.
And I was out. Like, so on sabbatical, half our church starts reading this book. I'm like, well, I guess I got to read this.
Yeah, they're all emailing me about it. Yeah, you need to read it so you can answer emails.
And so I'm excited to read that for a variety of reasons. Finally reading Side by Side by Ed Welch. And then I'm open to basically anything good on grief. I feel like pastorally, grief is such a hard thing to navigate. What ministers to this person might not minister to that person. And I just feel like sometimes we get paralyzed as a church in the grief scenarios. And so stuff on grief, which Ted, one of our deacons here, did some work on recently. But I'm just like, man, anything good on grief, I want to read and eat up. So,
Mike, what's the best thing you've read recently? What's on your list?
Yeah, so I've been reading Thomas Merton's No Man Is an Island as well. I looked to the men I want to be like when I grow up, and Gary Nebaker was always reading Thomas Merton, and that's the inside joke with the
Thomas Merton.
Thomas Merton.
Some of that.
He said that on a podcast once, but chapter seven, being and doing, a quote from that chapter, in order to settle down in the quiet of your own being, we must learn to be detached from the results of our own activity. And so that chapter in particular really spoke to me about seeking my identity in what I do, not in who I am and who God says I am. And, based on my union with Christ, I'm often looking outward to find my identity. So, his writing has been really helpful. I just blasted through James K. Smith's new book, On the Road to St. Augustine. I think it's his most pastoral book that he's written.
You were like, you got like a pre-release copy.
I did. I pre-ordered and got like a week early.
Wow.
And I read it in 2 weeks, which is probably the fastest I've ever read a book. But it's his most pastoral writing. I think he's able to think philosophically about the things that St. Augustine did in his life, and yet apply it pastorally to things like sex and ambition and friendship and fatherhood and motherhood and death even. So, I recommend that book. What I want to read is I want to go back, because of James K. Smith's book, On the Road to St. Augustine, I want to go back and read the Confessions again, Augustine's Confessions. So, just started that again, and I'm going to read the novel called The Brothers K by David James Duncan.
Not to be confused with
the actual the Brothers
Karamazov by Dostoevsky.
Right. No, not to be confused with that. But it's a book that happens it's a novel that is based in the 50s and 60s and 70s and travels with a dad and his sons and baseball. And so that story seems intriguing to me. So I'm going to jump into that.
I'm also rereading the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I forgot about that.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
That's on my bedstand reading.
You know they have movies now. Just kidding.
Wow.
Wow.
Relax, literary people. Don't freak out.
What about you, Bob?
All right. Best thing I've read recently. First of all, I'm still pondering Jake Meter's book, In Search of the Common Good. Done reading it, but I'm sort of still just marinating on some of the stuff he does there. I think he's doing some really unique and important work. And So I'm just sort of letting that book marinate. It's one of my favorite ones I've read recently, and I feel like he's saying some things that we really need to hear in sort of modern American culture, especially. So that one's been really good. The one I've just started this week that's blowing my mind is Jonathan Pennington, the Sermon on the Mount and Human Flourishing, I think, is the title of the book. Mm-hmm. It's a theological commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. Pennington is a professor at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I was hanging out with Will Walker recently. Walker and I have loved the Sermon on the Mount for years. Walker, when he worked here, used to take guys through the Sermon on the Mount as discipleship. And we've just all, I mean, we both read Dallas Willard back in the early 2000s and sort of his treatment of the Sermon on the Mount. And so I've just always tried to sort of, and we preached through the Sermon on the Mount here, whenever that was, Mike, 2011 or 12. And, mm-hmm. But Penny, and so there's always been pieces of the Sermon on the Mount that just bug me because there's number one, it's the most read and commented on portion of Scripture in history. So there's mm-hmm. more written and said about the Sermon on the Mount than any other part of the Bible.
It's the most sermon series comments that we get on YouTube on those sermons.
I mean, lots of people are interested in this. And it's been read in such different ways, right? So there's like Luther's way of reading it, which is basically like, this is to show you that you can never do any of this and you need grace. You know, like it's like Jesus didn't intend for you to try to do any of this. He just showed you your sin. And then there's like the more Catholic way of reading it, which is, this is the kind of life you should aspire to, but you probably won't be able to get there unless you're a monk. You know, so there's like these very disparate ways of reading it. And man, Pennington is just blowing my mind. I mean, he's basically saying, hey, I'm going to propose a way of reading the Sermon on the Mount that I think makes sense of all of it. And I mean, arguably the work he's doing is some of the most important work that will be done in our lifetime. I mean, it's just what he's proposing about how to read the Sermon on the Mount, I'm like, oh yeah, this makes sense. So he's trying to gather up all these streams of how it's been read and say, let me help you understand how the Sermon on the Mount is supposed to function as Christian scripture, and let me give you a framework for reading it. So that one I'm really, really enjoying right now. So
is Pennington that big book that you were carrying around? That two-volume situation?
No, that's a different one.
Bob's been walking around with this big old book, Chris. What's that all about?
That's the Michael McClellan's book, The Devil's Redemption, which is a history of Christian universalism. So it's sort of his treatment of it's the opposite of David Bentley Hart. So David Bentley Hart wrote a book on universalism, basically says everybody goes to heaven. McClellan wrote this book that basically says, actually, that's not true. Let me show you why. Here's 1,300 pages of historical research.
Large.
And so, that one's a little daunting.
Not
my favorite book. It's an interesting book. It's a good read. It kind of feels like one of those books that could have been 500 pages, but it's 1,300. Mm. You know, it's just like, you could have said this a lot faster. So
books like that bug me
of like, okay, let's cut this down a little bit. What's on my to-read list? I mean, I'm going on sabbatical, so I'll probably take a case of books I'll be reading tons of stuff. But like you, Mike, my inclination, number one, I'm going to read whatever I feel like because I'm on sabbatical, so I don't have to read anything. I'll just read whatever I feel like. But my inclination is I'd like to reread Calvin, Augustine, and I'd like to read Thomas Aquinas. I have never read Thomas Aquinas because he's hard to read, but I would just really like to marinate in those three original sources. Everything I'm reading right now and studying seems like everything kind of goes back to Augustine, mm-hmm. Aquinas, and Calvin as the three most important theologians probably in the history of the church. And so I just want to understand those guys as well as I possibly can. Mm. All right, let's talk culture. That was a long section on reading, guys.
Yeah.
Let's keep it moving. Culture. What broader American cultural realities are you most intrigued by right now? What do you have your eye on in the culture that's like, this is interesting to me?
So ever since we did the podcast on Mark Sayer's book and him highlighting the ways that culture is deformative, not that this hasn't been on my radar before, but it really stuck. It is so since reading Reappearing Church, I think that is, as far as reading broadly, more cultural, like I'm just looking for articles and commentary on just the deformative practices and the subtle ways that these things are creeping into life. And so it, you know, not super positive, but it's just speaking so much to, I think, just pastorally right now, things that I'm dealing with, confronting, and thinking about in multiple avenues. So that I would say that's probably, you know, what's going on politically. Sure. Okay. Kind of keep an eye on that, but less, that's less than just this sense of, okay, what's really deforming us?
I mean, culturally, this is short, but one of the things that I'm intrigued by still is just how many sexual identities exist and just keep popping up. And I,
a listener sent us a link with a question about that. And I read, there's like 13 of them on there.
And like, that just compounds how you already feel about it, you know? And there's just like, are we ever going to have an exhaustive list of all these different sexual identities? And then I just find myself bummed, sad, frustrated about all of that. So, I don't really know what to do about it. Some of the reading just gets you depressed, but yeah, that's the cultural thing that just keeps popping up.
Yeah. I just had to talk to my kids this morning about suicide. And because it's either an eating disorder because of a sadness of life, or a child, a 10-year-old committing suicide, or an 18-year-old committing suicide has happened within close proximity to us relationally. And I don't know what to say other than it was really sad to have to explain that to my 12-year-old all the way down to my 6-year-old. And it makes me think of the profession. I had to pull it up here, Heidelberg 26, where it says, I will trust him so much, God, our Father, that I do not doubt he will provide whatever I need for body and soul, and he will turn to my good whatever adversity he sends me in this sad world. And that phrase, in this sad world, was sticking out to me this morning as I was explaining this to my kids that, man, we live in a sad world, and our culture is sad. Our culture is lonely. Our culture is hiding things. We have friends that are hiding things, and they don't feel safe. So we cried together, we prayed together, but yeah, I don't know, as a father, that when I dreamt about being a dad, I never thought I'd have to do that.
Hmm. And suicide used to be kind of this every now and then random thing. And then in culture right now, it's younger, it's a lot more, and yeah.
Couple cultural realities I'm intrigued by. Maybe a year or two ago, we talked about Patrick Deneen's book, The End of Liberalism. And I'm just sort of standing back and watching what's happening. And because I think I was intrigued by his argument in that book of his argument is basically freedom has collapsed in on itself. Like, we're so free now that everything's falling apart. And that's, I think, what you see with sexual identities. I think it's what you see with even the deaths of despair. It's just like, I'm so free that I can just explore whatever, whether that's like drugs or really dark places on the internet or whatever. And it just leads me to places of deep despair and meaninglessness. So I'm just sort of watching and saying, I'm not sure where culture is headed. Like, I feel perplexed as someone watching to say, I don't know where we're going to be in 10 years. But I think Deneen is onto something. I think our culture is sort of self-destructing in the same way that Imperial Rome did. And, I don't know. It's intriguing to me, because I think there's all these cultural indicators that, and what I don't see, the pundit class in America, whether they're liberal or conservative, just sort of uses those as more ammunition for whatever their political agenda is. I don't see a whole lot of people going, our culture is falling apart. You know, like the yeah. things we've looked to for meaning are now falling apart. And I think the church has a really profound opportunity to step in there. But that's something I've got my finger on. The other thing is, I actually really am interested in politics right now. You know, there was a recent Democratic debate, and I know they're doing a bunch of those, but like, as I watch, I'm just fascinated by how Bernie Sanders looks like a total moderate all of a sudden. Like, everybody's trying to run as far left of Bernie Sanders as possible. And so I realize you have Trump on the right, and whoever the left candidate is going to be so, like, it feels to me like, where's the candidate for the rest of us? Like,
for real,
where, who, what's left for those of us that want to that want a sort of realistic approach to some sense of virtue and, you know, traditional nationalism in a good sense, right? Mm. Traditional American values. So I'm really intrigued, but I'm also intrigued because I think that some of the Democratic candidates right now are pressing on some of these cultural issues in ways that are really interesting to me. I watched Elizabeth Warren recently talk about breaking up the tech companies, Google and Facebook, using monopoly laws against them. And I'm like, thankfully somebody's saying that. I don't know why it's Elizabeth Warren is the only person who thinks that's a good idea. Like, that's a real problem. Like, the power that those companies have is really troubling to me when you think about how much of our data they have, how much of a stranglehold they have on how we do life, going back to our practices, right? Yeah. And I just think, like, I can't believe that the only politician to raise their hand and say, hey, we should break these companies up because they're monopolies, is Elizabeth Warren. It seems like, gosh, a lot of people should be talking about this. So I'm just intrigued by how those two things seem to be coming together, how what's going on in the political reality right now sort of seems to be dovetailing with some of these broader cultural trends that people are starting to put their fingers on. And what's funny is the political people all want to solve them. Like, oh, if we just do this or if we just do that, it's going to fix it. And I'm just suspicious that there's no going back from where we are right now. There's no fixing this stuff. Probably there's a real course correction coming for us culturally, and I'm not sure what that's going to look like. Hey, let's go to the third category, inchoate angst. You guys don't even like – you thought my word was too snooty.
No, I liked it.
Well, once you defined it, Mike and I were on board. Chris already knew what it was. But yeah.
What's bugging you right now? You're not sure how to address, but you're beginning to pray and think about it.
Over the last couple of weeks, I've spent some time teaching on this, but also concerned about it. And that is, this is just a little sliver into the church, okay? And that is parents who have a lack of intentionality into their children's friendships. This is a little pastoral soapbox real quick, but I think parents, they're afraid to be engaged with their kids here. They're afraid to, at the risk of their kid rebelling, or at the risk of even offending some other family or some other friend, that they just take their hand off the wheel when it comes to
who my kids are friends with,
how we're even talking about it. Like, it's not bad for your kid to have friends that are non-Christians and stuff like that, as long as you're navigating all of that. And I just see this kind of neglect, but worry. Like, there's this, like, how do I get my kids to get good friends? And I'll just go pray about it, you know? And I'm just like, well, actually there are some things you can do. So that's one of the things. It's angsty, but it's more kind of pastoral burden. And I especially want to equip Coram Deo to be thinking about that. Parents of teenagers around here, to be proactive on those things. There's things you can do without helicoptering around your kids. And there's things you can do to build wisdom into your children so that they're picking good friends. But it's going to take some parental involvement. And instead of involvement, I see a lot of, would you pray for us? And they're just kind of backing up. And so instead, I want to engage that appropriately.
As an angry person.
It's a good intro.
I am not in particularly angsty about anything right now. I feel like I'd be making something up. So
that's so Thomas Merton-y of
you. I hope there's that's growth in my heart.
Man.
So emotional growth.
Does this mean you're walking around with, like, you're smiling all the time and freaking people
out? I still need to work on that. I still need to work on the outward expression of joy a little bit.
Yeah. So here's where I am. That Sayers book, Reappearing Church, really put this book has been super helpful. It's timely too, because it put a finger on some things that I think I was feeling inside and have been angsty about here. At first, City, I love you, but let me just be honest. I have concern that as a church, we've kind of hit this place of coasting and comfortability, that we're pushing on 4 years. Things have gone well. We're stable. We have a lot of our systems and processes run well. But there's also this sense of, are we seeking renewal for ourselves, renewal for our church, renewal for our city? Is there a vibrant faith and walk with the Lord, a vibrant spiritual life that translates into missional energy? I'm angsty that that is not where we are right now, and how to talk about that, how to invite people into that, how to press on that. And then I think also too, for those who are leaders, how to bring leaders into that and have good conversations about those who are leading others, discipling others, and bearing burdens in some ways. So I don't entirely know. We're kind of rounding out the end of 2019, moving into 2020. So spending a lot of time thinking and praying about direction for next year. And I think one of the things that was provoking for me in Sayer's book is setting aside maybe ministry strategy and more, what does renewal strategy look like? What does renewal movement look like? And so that's got me thinking.
Man, you teed me up because I'm kind of angsty about some of the same stuff.
Yeah.
So here's what I've been thinking about, and this connects to my reading as well. It connects to Jake Meter's stuff. It connects to Jonathan Pennington. Jonathan Pennington's point in the Sermon on the Mount is the Sermon on the Mount is a vision of human flourishing. Mm-hmm. Jesus is giving us a vision of what human flourishing looks like, and it takes the gospel and virtue to make that a reality. Mm-hmm. So what I, as I connect the dots on all that, I say, okay, what does it mean? The question I'm asking is, what does it mean for the church to be an alternative society? What does it mean for the church to be an alternative people, to be a people who live in the same world, but do life in that world so radically differently that it's compelling, that it's engaging, that it's life-giving, that it's shaping, right? That we are formed like Sermon on the Mount people instead of like the world. Mm. And I think my angst, Chris, is, and I don't know if our people are up for that. And when I say that, I don't mean that aspirationally they're not up for it. I mean, what I start to see is like a little bit of that coasting of just like, well, that with youth sports and with my job and with where my life is at, I just can't like, I mean, I'll show up on Sundays and I'll come to gospel community 2 out of 4 weeks a month. But man, other than that, I'm kind of like pretty maxed out, you know, and that might be, it feels a little cynical for me to say that because I know that as I think about who's listening to this podcast, not everybody's feeling that. Man, some people are really longing for more. And so I don't mean to throw everybody in the same camp, but I just think like what I think about is how's that alternative society going to come into being without a deep commitment to presence and a lot of sort of schedule readjustments, you know, and life readjustments and pattern readjustments. And I'm not sure how to lead that. I'm really thankful for what we have on Sunday mornings and for the faithfulness of our people to gospel community. I feel like, hey, we've got 2 moments during people's week and sometimes more because sometimes they're meeting up for discipleship and whatever. So I feel like, man, compared to the average church in America, man, we have people's commitment, but I'm not sure the commitment we have is going to be enough to sustain discipleship in the new era that we're living in because of how deformative technology is, because of how deformative education is, because of how many influences, like you pointed out, Chris, are in our lives shaping us in other ways that are outside of the kingdom of God. And so I'm not sure what to do with any of that because I don't have an answer to it. It's not like so therefore we're going to start this thing or do this thing or change this thing. It's just, we started doing this every morning of the week prayer meeting, and 9 or 10 or 12 people show up every morning, which I'm really thankful for that. But I'm also like, we have a church of 700 people, you know,
but
like,
it feels sad that 9 or 10 people every morning is like revival.
Right.
Yeah.
And it feels sad to me because I feel like what I'm trying to do in that is take away every possible objection. Like the only objection now is I just can't get up that early, or I have to be at work that early, or hey, that's not workable with my kids, which all three of those are good objections. But I'm saying, hey, but if we're here every morning of the week at 6:30, I think most people can kind of figure out a way to make that work. You know, not 100% of our church, but man, 50-60% of our church can probably figure out a way to make that work. No one's really doing that. Mm-hmm. No one's making that work. And the challenge for me is I think I'm a skeptic even of myself. And so I'm like, well, I just have high expectations of people. I just need to let them live their life. Well, you know, like why does that matter? You know, is coming to an early morning prayer meeting make you a better Christian? No, of course not. Going back to your thing on Galatians, right? Like, no, we're not imposing a new legalism here. But for me, it is an indicator of like what really matters to people. You know, like prayer is not something that really matters to people, because if it did, they would show up to a prayer meeting. And so that's just me being, sorry, listeners, I'm just being honest. Like, I'm just telling you, if prayer mattered to you, you'd find ways to pray. So I just step back and go, man, I'm really thankful for what God has done and is doing. I'm also really perplexed about what does it look like to roll that forward in the world that we live in?
Yeah.
In a way that actually forms an alternative people that really do look like kingdom people. Because I'm not sure, man.
What's the angst tied to the morning gathering? Because maybe people are praying at home.
No, they're not.
Maybe some are.
I know them. I've had enough conversations with them. Some of them are.
I mean, we did.
Some of them are.
We did a podcast on the first 15 minutes of your day, right?
Yes.
Because you were getting questions.
Right. Yeah, but what are you, like, what's your aim, your pastoral aim to, like, let's get together and pray together every morning of the week? Like, what?
It's that, to Mark Sayers' category, it's the patterns, right? It's just like, hey, I just want to, like, form some patterns for us that just say, like, hey, as a people, this is kind of what we do. And what I feel like is, I can't say that right now. I can't say, as a people, Coram Deo Church meets in the morning to pray. I can say as a people, we gather for worship and we're liturgical. I can say as a people, we're committed to gospel community. I can say some very, very small subset of us thinks it's interesting to pray in the morning, but I can't say we as a people have that as a pattern. And again, I'm trying not to throw people under the bus here, because I'm not looking for 100% participation, but I just feel like that's not us yet. That's not the people. It's like a very, very small segment of the people. And that's always been true with prayer in my entire ministry going back 20 years. You know, every time we've had a prayer meeting, which I've had almost weekly for the entire time I've been in ministry, there's always kind of a few people that are pretty faithful to that and a lot that aren't. And so that's the angst, is just like, I'm not after measuring people's performance in prayer, but I am after an ability to say with integrity, we as a people are committed to prayer. And I don't know. I'm just not convinced that's the case. I think it's possibly the case.
Yeah, and it's representative of, are we committed to those countercultural practices that, because in this day and age, the challenge is significant. I mean, in some ways, it is going to be harder to switch rhythm and sort of deprogram the ways that we have been formed. And so the sense of being committed to a prayer meeting, you're not measuring, you know, that, but it does speak to, what are we willing to do? Like, to what degree are we willing to seek the Lord?
Because you know what we are committed to? We're committed to Nebraska football. We're committed to social media. We're committed to all kinds of things that actually I see the people of our church engaging in deeply.
Yes.
We're committed to Stranger Things or whatever your binge show, like whatever your Netflix show is.
Yes.
Oh boy. Like, there are things that people in our church are highly committed to, and all I have to do is pull up their social media profiles and you can tell what they're committed to, you know? And so again, I'm not trying to have a bash session on people. I'm trying to describe some angst I have of what you're saying, Chris, of like, we're committed to certain things. I'm just not sure the things we're committed to are going to form us into the kind of people that meaningfully show to the culture and alternative society in the world we're moving into.
Yes.
Yeah. And so some of that angst too, right, comes out of just this, there's this huge gap between all of us could agree and the whole, you know, your church, First City, could agree to this. Coram Deo would agree. Yeah, culture's scary. Culture's going to hell in a handbasket. Lots of bad things are happening. But then we align with that culture far too quickly instead of saying, we're actually a part of a different kingdom.
Yeah, I don't think, I wouldn't even use the language of we align with that culture. I think we don't align with that culture or notionally, but we actually do align with it in our patterns and practices, right? So like no one in our church would say we love the culture we're in and we're signed up for it. Yep. We would all say, no, we want to be different from that. It's just that I'm not sure that we're actually doing the things that cause us to be able to be different.
So the markers of countercultural life, the ways we sort of mark that are not to say that they're bad or wrong, but they might be superficial in a lot of ways.
Right.
Where prayer and renewal practices, that takes it to a whole other level, and it actually the level that it takes to be countercultural.
It takes level of commitment.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and so this is where I start to ask how many of these things blend with the things that I'm seeing in the culture, right? Like part of this is we live really distributed lives. You know, we work here and we live there and our kids go to school over there. Like, so there's all these patterns that we already have that actually make it difficult. If we all lived in the same neighborhood, I actually think it'd be real easy to get together to pray together because we just walk across the street and you pray your living room on Monday and my living room on Tuesday, Mike, you know? And so they're like, that's what I'm saying is like this, this angst is connected to bigger things that make me say, I don't know that as a pastor, I really know how to form a countercultural people. I think I'm trying to do the best I can on Sunday mornings, but man, I feel the pressure of the church has some work to do in setting a different trajectory here. And I'm just not sure how to do that work.
Yeah. It's good.
Man. Wah, wah. What a podcast, right?
What are you encouraged by?
Yeah. What are we happy about? Mike,
you're happy. What are you happy
right
about?
I'm happy all the time.
All right, so here's the thing I'm encouraged about. Let me tell you a thing I'm encouraged about. I'm encouraged about the opportunity that exists right now in the world for good theological training. Like just the way the internet opens up all kinds of possibilities to get good content out there and the way that's happening in the developing world. I'm just like, man, there's actually really cool things happening. I'm excited about the rise of the global church. I'm excited about global church planting. I think there are really good things happening. But what's interesting to me is like the things I'm excited about tend to be happening outside of America and the things I'm not less excited about tend to be happening inside America. So, but I am hopeful and excited about some of the trends I see in the broader, you know, sweep of history right now.
Yeah. And along the line, the theme we've been talking about, that there are a lot of people encouraging renewal and encouraging, hey, what does it look like to be this countercultural people? And they're doing it in a way that is actually calling us to something great and beautiful and calling us to flourishing. And so I'm encouraged that the voices and the messages of this are actually positive. They're not kind of the crank just yelling at culture. Yeah. It's like, hey, flourishing is what we're after. Yeah. And so I love that. And I think that's getting behind that kind of tone. And I think too, for First City, something that I'm super encouraged by what's happening in First City is over the past going on 2 years now, we have really made it a point to want to have a culture that loves God's word and starting different rhythms and adjusting some things on Sundays and then with Bible studies and teaching people how to study scripture well. And I see a growing love of God's word taking place in our church and the effect that's having in discipleship and being able to disciple from the word. So I love that that's happening at First City.
That's exciting.
I'm happy about... happy. I don't like using that word. I'm joyful about this group of guys I've been meeting with since January. We've been going through the Heidelberg Catechism all year, going day by day, maybe multiple days at a time. But we've just been reading the questions and answers and getting into scripture. And you know, guys have fallen off the bandwagon throughout the year, and it's kind of whittled down to this core group of guys that have maintained attendance. And my wife was asking me, are you sad that, you know, the group isn't as big? And I was like, no, guys are showing up and we're reading the Bible together and we're pondering deep things like, you know, why baptism matters and why communion, the Lord's table matters. And that's really encouraging to me. I'm happy and joyful that that group exists and that we're continuing on through the end of the year.
Two things. One is I think I personally am figuring out what it looks like to have fun, which, you know, I'm almost 40, so I should be trying to figure that out. And so this last summer really catered to some of that of a little bit more lightheartedness, a little bit more able to let down, able to
you can literally let your hair down now.
Yeah, which yeah,
you got so much of it.
The listeners can't even see my hair, Mike. Okay, but just the ability to stop white knuckling some things, stop being worried or preoccupied about certain stuff, confronting some low grade anxiety. But in the church, so secondly, one of the things I'm encouraged about around here is which has been going on for quite a number of years now, but it feels like there's some traction now with the Church of Coram Deo just becoming more and more self-aware of their own stories.
Mm, yeah.
And then the traction that that gets you pastorally with certain conversations, whether it's marriage, whether it's with a single gal or whatever that means for people is just helping people understand their own stories. And then therefore, the more aware I am, the more I can see God's invitation to sanctification in my story and in my life and my sin patterns. And so all of that. So that's pretty encouraging to me. I would say that that did not exist 4 years ago. And it might have taken 4 or 5 years, but that's okay. So I'm pretty encouraged about that.
Well, listeners, I hope this has been a fun episode or two to listen to. We are going to take a break for the next few months. So here's what I want to invite you to do. I'm going to let Mike store up all the listener feedback for 3 months.
Wow.
And then February, we're just going to tackle whatever in the world people have wanted to put on the radar. So we get emails regularly of, hey, would you talk about this topic? Would you talk about that? So keep sending those to podcast@cdomaha.com and we'll just store them up. And like I said, in the meantime, we'll put out an episode a month just to keep the feed live and keep you fueled up with some stuff from the archives. And we'll look to jump back into a weekly rhythm next February. In the meantime, have a wonderful and glorious Advent season and Happy New Year and Merry Christmas and
Happy Halloween.
Happy
Thanksgiving. We'll catch you in 2020.
Happy Hanukkah.
Catch you in next year.